Thanks a lot. Before I start, I want to spend just a couple of minutes to tell you, yeah, this is a really great, great place, this institute. But I just want to spend a couple of minutes to tell you about another great place to do collaborative research at the interface of biology and mathematics. And we call it Nimbus, and it's in Knoxville. And it's basically the same idea as ENSYS, that is here in Santa Barbara, and NESNT in Duke I use them. So this is a place where people come to collaborate, and when they go back to their home institutions, and then again. And this is a really exciting opportunity. Moreover, yeah, and this is something that is mostly supported by NSF Division of Biology, so the emphasis is really on biological questions. And in a year, NESNT will run out of NSF money, so we're basically going to be the only game in town. So I really encourage you to check our website. And there is a deadline coming that probably it's too soon, but there will be now one in September. And this is, as I already said, it's a great, great place to do transdisciplinary research at the interface of mathematics, biology, but we're also expanding towards social science. And this is the title of my talk, and I'll be talking about something very different from what you've heard in this conference before, but there is a connection. And the connection is that the things that I'll be discussing are related to a major transition in evolutionary biology. And there are a couple of slides here with the information that is pretty similar to what you've already seen here, and in particular Rick's talk yesterday. But I just want to emphasize one particular feature of major evolutionary transitions that I don't think has been stressed enough here or actually in the whole field. And this is division of labor between low-level units that combine to create something new. This is really, I believe, the most important feature of major evolutionary transitions, and that's what produces dramatic increase in complexity and in diversity. And then division of labor is something that is well appreciated in economics and in social studies, and Adam Smith emphasized the number of different advantages of the division of labor. And there are multiple examples of this in biology and evolution. So basically each major evolutionary transition is, there is a particular division of labor linked to that. And I actually had a paper on this, and I believe that's why I'm here in this conference, I was invited, where it deals with evolution of multicellularity as a result of the division of labor, where it's accomplished by developmental plasticity. But what I'll be talking about here are actually human societies and human evolution. And it's something that has been discussed a lot and received a lot of interest. And of course, this is something that division of labor in humans requires cooperation. And as we know from all this theory that has been built over the last 50 years, evolving cooperation is not easy. There are certain obstacles that that one has to overcome. And in particular, one to which hundreds or maybe thousands of papers have been devoted is vulnerability to cheaters and free riders. But there is another thing that I believe is very important, and that's been kind of neglected in the majority of this literature, and it concerns the social structure of our ancestors. I'm talking now about cooperation in humans. And basically, it's also related to initial conditions in the models that people use. And I'll explain everything in a few minutes. But let me give you kind of a background picture of what I'm talking about. So here we have this tree, diversification of primates, and it started about 65 million years ago when dinosaurs went extinct. And this is a kind of more detailed tree for the past 20 million years. This is a separation between humans and chimps that happened about 7 million years ago. And from paleontologists, we know from paleontological data, we know that this 6-7 million years have been very interesting years. First of all, there was a large number of different species that paleontologists identify, and you can see that at certain times in the past there were multiple human species present. As recently as 30,000 years ago, apparently there were at least three or maybe even four different species. Well, we just arranged in a particular order. I think these are different genera and but here the horizontal axis that does have a meaning, and this is time. So as I was saying, a lot of interesting things were happening during this time, and in particular our brain size and presumably intelligence was increasing. So this is the past, this is the present. And as you can see, over the, there was an apparently exponential increase in brain size, and presumably intelligence was started about 500,000 years ago. So, and there's a number of very exciting and important questions that scientists ask about this process. What makes us the uniquely unique species? How we came to be? And for a scientist, for evolutionary biologist, that last question means basically what are what were selective forces that were driving our evolution? What were the most important factors and parameters and mechanisms? And what were the relevant spatial and temporal scales? And equally important is this question: what are the implications of our evolutionary past for modern humans, for our attitudes, behaviors, and preferences? What makes us the uniquely unique species? Here's a list that I lifted from a relatively recent paper by Mark Flynn with co-authors. And if you look through this list, basically almost everything is unique: ecology, demography, development, and of course extraordinary mental capabilities, language, culture, and complex social groups and behaviors. And this is what I will be talking about. This is what some people call a human egalitarian syndrome. And by this, people typically mean a complex of cognitive perspective, preferences, and norms that promote equality and collective attitudes over inequality. And this type of behavior is universal in hunter-gatherers, and that strongly suggests that this is our ancestral state in a sense. So basically, these egalitarian norms and behaviors apparently have emerged in our ancestors long time before, like the French Revolution or Marx and Engels, right? And to understand how it happened is really a big puzzle that still requires an explanation. And so why it's puzzling? Of course, individuals who live in groups and animals living in groups, we have a lot of common interests. Right, we have to defend their territory, we have to get access to different resources, we have to protect their mating opportunities and things like that. But these common interests don't mean that there is no conflict. There is a lot of conflict between individuals, there is a lot of competition, and actually there is a lot of differences between individuals. And as a result of this, stronger individuals are able to take resources from weak individuals, and dominance hierarchies emerge. And the distribution of resources, including mating opportunities, is very non-even. Alpha individuals dominate. Anthropologists, when we talk about egalitarian syndrome and egalitarian behavior, we typically talk about three different aspects of this: meat sharing, pair bonding, and political egalitarianism. In animals, meat sharing happens, but it typically can be explained in a very efficient way just by the mechanism that biologists refer to as tolerated scrounging. It's easy to give meat than to try to keep it from our individuals who are trying to take it from you. While in foragers, sharing is widespread, and what is very interesting and puzzling, individuals who actually make the killing, they don't get a higher share on their families. Pair bonding. In chimpanzees, mating is promiscuous, but dominant individuals get majority of mating. Like alpha male would get maybe 70-80% of mating. While in hunter-gatherers, a man typically has a single wife. And political egalitarianism. In chimpanzees, dominant individuals, bullies, can completely dominate any given individual of the whole group. for a particular reason or with no reason at all. While in foragers, there is a variety of cultural practices that anthropologists call leveling mechanisms that are directed against dominant individuals or very successful individuals or very lucky individuals who may try to dominate the group and monopolize the resources. So what I'll describe you is a part of a bigger project that attempts to understand the origins of these egalitarian preferences in a hierarchically organized society. And I will be focusing on social instincts, on something that is presumably controlled by genes, and something that came to be before culture, before language, before religion, and things like that. And meat sharing has been analyzed a lot, and there has been multiple papers written on that, only using more or less traditional models of cooperation, like prisoner's dilemma, reciprocity, and things like that. In contrast, transition to pair bonding, from promiscuity to pair bonding, received much less attention from theoreticians. But this was really a major evolutionary transition because it opened the path to the creation of family and made possible intergenerational interactions and also made possible different coalitions and kinship networks both within groups and between groups. Once individuals know their powers, different kinship relationships become much, much less apparent, and that changed dramatically the evolutionary dynamics of our species. And this is a topic that received a lot of interest among evolutionary biologists, and several books have been published on this. I highly recommend on this, and also some theoretical work has been done. But what I'll be talking about here is the third part of this egalitarian syndrome, and it's related to coalitionary control of bullies. And by bullies here, I mean the strongest, most dominant individuals, like alpha males, for example, in the group. And you cannot really resist them on your own because dominant individuals are much stronger. So the only way to do that is by using somebody's help, by building coalitions. And that actually also has some implications for modern humans because our behavior, our evolutionary psychology in different situations that involve conflict is presumably affected by what was happening in the past. So there has been a number of theories of altruism and cooperation, as already mentioned, and that received enormous attention of theoreticians. Kin selection is where help is directed towards kin. Your relatives, reciprocity, you do something to me, you help me now, I'll help you in the future. Punishment is getting a lot of attention lately. You basically, if you punish individuals, you can make them to do anything you want. And group selection. But these theories are not quite applicable to the situation that I'm looking at. And in particular, there is no social role asymmetry here. For example, if helping behavior is driven by your relatedness, when you're going to help bully in an equal way as you're going to help the victim of an aggression, right? Or if it's reciprocity. Punishment is very important indeed and can do a lot of things. But the thing with our ancestral structure is that bullies are the punishers, right? So the strongest individuals are those who will punish anybody, ours, but nobody will be really able to punish them. So these theories are not really applicable to understand transition to more egalitarian behavior. On the other hand, there is a set of theories of coalition and alliance formation that do focus on helping behavior, on different dynamics, patterns, and things like that. May have some limitations, in particular we typically look at very simple interactions of two against one, and also there is no social role asymmetry there, but they can be extended. And there are three general approaches that people use. One, you basically look for behaviors and strategies that maximize fitness. right? But then there are questions how individuals are really able to identify these strategies if there are many of them, for example. Alternatively, you can postulate that individuals use simple heuristic rules in their behavior. For example, help your relative first, right? But when you may run into a problem where the rule, heuristic rule that you postulate in your model may not be evolutionarily stable, may not be realized. And finally, there is kind of a more sophisticated method, but also much more complicated method. It's where you look at the evolution of behavioral rules and try to see what will happen. So I'll describe a kind of a basic model that's been around for more than 30 years, and this model will produce the initial state for my attempt to understand how egalitarian preferences can evolve. Right? So I call it the eight-state model. So there is a number of individuals, and very different. They differ in their strengths. Okay? And there are some resources available. And I assume that individuals occasionally discover some units of resource, right, of value B. And each time somebody finds the resource, there is another individual who observes that. And that other individual, potential bully, may try to take the resource from the owner, right? And I will be using a simple and classical framework of asymmetric hawk and dove game. And there are two strategies: escalate, fight over the resource, or give up it without fight, display. And if you use kind of the matrix of payoffs, there are two roles, owner and the bully. And there are payoffs for the owner first and for the bully. And if the bully is not fighting, then the owner keeps the resource. But if the bully escalates, decide to fight, then it depends. P here is the probability that the owner wins, right? And 1 minus P is the probability that the bully wins. So what people do here, the way to capture different behavioral rules is to postulate, kind of this is a standard way of dealing with that, is to postulate that there is a certain function that controls the probability that an individual escalates in a conflict. And this function depends on the difference in strength between two individuals that encounter each other, right? And then you can say that, for example, you can specify this function as something as shape function, and there is a location parameter, and you can interpret this location parameter as aggressiveness in a particular role. So here we're dealing with bullies and owners, so there will be two genetically controlled parameters, X and Y, that control aggressiveness in the role of the bully and in the role of the owner. Okay. And then you also have to specify the probability what one or another wins, and it depends on the difference in strengths. You specify cost and benefits, okay, and this can be expressed in terms of the resource that we are fighting for. And then finally, you have to translate the resource that individuals accumulate into reproductive success, right? And basically the assumption here is that your fitness is proportional to the amount of resource that you accumulated after the number of transitions like that. But of course you have to normalize. And it doesn't have to be linear. So there is this coefficient beta here. And this function is actually well known in economics. And there is a whole theory of a whole body of theory that's called contest theory, right? And for example, you can write the fitness expected payoff in a conflict between n individuals. So this is what we're fighting for. This is the probability that individual I wins the conflict, and when that individual pays the costs. And for example, this model has been used for competition between different firms, or for different lobbying efforts. The more you invest in the competition, the more likely you're going to win this. So there is the whole body of theory on this, and that's what I'm using here. So the model is known, and its behavior is well understood. Some of you may have seen the paper that got a lot of attention a year and a half ago, a paper in Nature on evolution of overconfidence. Okay, so it's kind of related to that. And what is known here is that the cost of fighting is relatively high when individuals, they become very cautious, they don't fight, and weaker individuals give up their resources to stronger individuals. And as a result of this, there is very strong inequality in reproductive success, right? And then there are certain parameters like evaluation error and conflict intensity that affect the dynamics, the outcome, move aggressiveness one way or another. So this is a kind of my starting point. And I want to see if it's possible for helping behavior to evolve in this situation. And I do it in the following way. I postulate that whenever there is a conflict between two individuals, a third one can see it and may decide to interfere on the behalf of one party or another one. If this decision is made, then now we're going to have a coalition of two individuals fighting against one. So we have to redefine the strength of the coalition. Yeah, this is supposed to be S bar, this is the average. And this particular function, it captures the possibility that two individuals, there is some synergicity in the effects of two individuals on the strength of the coalition. And it's related to the Lanchester law that's been used in military science for almost 100 years. And then, because now there is a third role, third social role that individuals can be at, we have now the third parameter Z that controls aggressiveness in the role of helper, and we want to now see if and under what conditions helping behavior can evolve. But before we do that, we need to specify costs and benefits. Right? And what I'm making, and the major assumption that I'm making here is that the helper does not get anything from the individual that is being helped. All right, so here there are three individuals, so there are three different payoffs. For example, helper decides to escalate, and in this case, if bully withdraws, the owner keeps the resource. Helper and bully and the helper, they don't get anything. But if the bully escalates and fights, when owner can withdraw, owner can attempt to be to free ride here, or owner can escalate as well. And if owner escalates, there is a coalition, and coalition can win or can lose, right? And what I want to draw your attention to is that under no conditions the payoff of the helper is positive. It's either zero if there is no fight, or it's negative. So helper is never getting anything back for his contribution to the fight, right? So our logic should immediately tell us that it's impossible for helping behavior to evolve. You only pay the cost and nothing else, right? But there is something we are forgetting. We're forgetting about the fact that these individuals live in a group, and there is within group competition that is always present. And this within group competition leads to something that is a very interesting feature. And that's something that I call an egalitarian drive. So just imagine the fitness consequences of a transfer of the resource from one individual to another one for an observer, right? So this is individual I, right? It's individual I fitness, and it depends on the resource that individual I has. But there is this denominator at the bottom. And now assume that alpha individual, alpha takes resource from omega individual. So the resource of omega is decreased by delta, and the resource of alpha is increased by delta, right? So now individual I will suffer from this transition if the denominator here is smaller than one over there, right? And then it's very simple, trivial thing to show that this will happen whenever the function that converts our resource into reproductive success grows faster than linearly. This is another attempt to illustrate what happens. So now I'm assuming that beta is equal to 2. So this is quadratic. So now we have the sum of squares. And we can represent the sum of squares as the average squared plus the variance. And you can see immediately that there is this variance here. And increasing the variance decreases each individual reproductive success, right? And let me give you another illustration. Just imagine three individuals, like I'm an observer and there are two guys over here. Assume that each of us has one unit of the resource, right? If the conversion of resource, well, under any circumstances, under any conditions, we're all gonna have the same reproductive success of 33%, right? So now imagine that one of, like A takes the resource from B. So now A has two units of the resource. B has zero, I still have one. If this function is linear, I don't care, right? I still have my 33% of reproduction. But if the function is nonlinear, say quadratic, when these two units of the resource convert into number four, and that gives 80% of reproduction. So now I suffer directly, although I didn't do anything. So this is a very simple feature of this classical model that somehow was missed. And basically it means that whenever you have individuals that compete for resource in a group, everybody in this group has very strong motivation to get as much resource as possible, but you don't want to have you want our individuals to be equal. You don't want any variation among our individuals, right? Just think about, I don't know, like faculty in the department, right? There is always limited resources. You want to be a superstar, but you don't want to be anybody else to be a superstar, because somehow that our person will eventually draw resources from you. And I believe this is a very powerful force that would produce a strong selection towards a more egalitarian distribution. Of course, that's just what I described to you so far are the consequences of transition of resource from one party to another one. If I'm going to help somebody and try to prevent somebody increasing the resource level, I'll have to pay the costs. So the question is this effect strong enough to overcome the cost? Unfortunately, the model becomes pretty complex now, and it cannot be, not much can be done analytically, so one has to do numerical simulations. And then you start playing with different parameters and trying to see what happens here. And these are just some graphs to illustrate the dynamics. So now these are two graphs for different group sizes, and there are two sets of curves that correspond to two values of the synergicity coefficient alpha. So there are three different colors. They correspond to aggressiveness in the role of owner, bully, and the helper, and the helper is green, right? And you can see that this helping threshold increases in individuals. Basically, the meaning of this graph is that individuals become much more helpful. And when in this graph shows the distribution of the reproductive success across different ranks, and the dashed line is the initial state before evolution of helping, and the solid lines correspond to more even distribution after evolution of helping. And this one corresponds to alpha equal 3, and that one to alpha equal 2. And the insert here shows the dynamics of the index of inequality. And this is a Gini index, and it's used in economics. And basically, it's normalized difference in incomes between different individuals. And there is, I have another graph that shows the dynamics of this Gini index over the last 50 years. So for example, there is a dramatic increase in inequality in China and a continuous increase in inequality in the US, while like in Scandinavia and in Norway, and for whatever reason in Bulgaria, it is becoming much smaller. But the values here, you can see it's above 20%. So now, if we try to summarize the result of numerical simulations and see what kind of Gini index we can get from that model, you can see that it can be pretty low, like 10% or even 20% as a result of evolutionary dynamics in the groups that I'm looking at. And this is a way to summarize the effects of four different parameters, alpha here and evaluation error, beta, the strength of competition, and the group size. But the point of this graph is to show that there are some parameter combinations under which inequality basically disappears almost completely. So what are conditions for this? The most important one is that coefficient alpha that I mentioned already. It has to be sufficiently high, right? So there should be some synergy or coordination between individuals in the coalition who are fighting against a single target. Also, the effect is most important in smaller groups that are subject to stronger competition, in which dominance hierarchies are very strong. And also what is interesting is that this effect is promoted when individuals are able to evaluate their strengths with relatively small error. I want to emphasize that this does not produce complete equality in the group, but inequality is significantly reduced. What I think is why this effect is very powerful is that it doesn't really require relatedness, group selection, reciprocity, or reputation. It's just driven by pure individual selection and individual preferences. In building this model, I made certain simplifying assumptions, but there is a number of factors that actually should make this effect even stronger. For example, multiple helpers. If you have multiple helpers, the costs will be smaller and the probability of winning will be bigger, right? I also did not allow something that is known as winner and loser effect. Under some conditions, I may be motivated to prevent somebody from winning a competition, so an individual would be less motivated to attack me in the past. And also, I did not allow, one can allow for some kind of group selection and group competition. So there are also some more general implications of this egalitarian drive, because it creates conditions for subsequent evolution of many different features like inequity aversion, empathy, compassion, egalitarian and normal moral values. It also promotes widespread cooperation via coalition formation. There are also some implications for modern humans. If indeed these type of behaviors are coded in our genes, there should be both instincts to dominate, but also instincts to help the weak against the strong. And there are some interesting interpretation linked to modern welfare policies. And just finally, a few words about emergence of moral values. So for Darwin, morality was kind of a continuation of social instinct that emerged once individuals became sufficiently intellectual powers became sufficiently strong. Chris Bohm, who published a brilliant book just last year, he talks at length about the importance of different social practices, including punishment, language, gossip, and different things of social selection. But I think looking for the roots of these behaviors, for genetically controlled roots of this behavior, is equally important. And Franz De Waal also had another book recently where it was great, that talks about moral behavior in animals. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So it seems to me that there is a sort of a very strong prediction in what you're saying, right? The concavity or convexity of this return on bullying function. You gave a nice example of this happening in academic departments. So do we have any idea what whether we're concave or convex in our academic societies whether you can actually...
Last year I spent a couple of months in Toulouse School of Economics talking to economists because it's something they were interested in. And we were looking for data. And the only things that I've been able to find after discussions and looking through the literature is basically some anecdotal evidence that is related to how lobbying effort is converted into success of different initiatives. And also, there is, like, you can imagine, like, you give money to your politicians in Congress, and then you see which way they're going to go. Or if there is political events, elections, how much people put into the campaign and who's going to win. So this data seem to suggest that it indeed grows faster than linear. That whoever puts more resource into competition will get a significantly bigger share of the reward. But that's all I've been able to find.
So the rich are getting richer.
Oh, yeah. Yes, but I don't think revenge, well, it's definitely been playing a very important role in human evolution. Like with hunter-gatherers, for example, most of the deaths, I think, are motivated by revenge. But I'm not familiar with any modeling attempts to do that. But revenge would be related to reciprocity in a sense, right?
Okay, I think the mechanism you identified is very important, but do you have any idea why only ancient human can exceed this threshold? Do you think that the ancient human has some special reason why alpha is very large compared to others, or group was small?
Well, I can explain it in terms of this parameter. So basically this alpha, so I think a couple of parameters here that are most important can be directly linked to cognitive abilities of humans. For example, alpha. Alpha measures the synergicity or extent of the ability of two individuals to work together, right? So that, I think, can be clearly linked to intelligence and to the ability to coordinate the actions. And also with sigma, the ability to evaluate the strength of the opponents, I think it also can be linked to mental abilities. But again, it's kind of the hand waving, so I just invoke some additional process that is outside of the model in a sense, but that's all I can do here. Yeah. Well, bullying is universal. So whenever you have animals living in the group, stronger individuals will starve. Yeah. But helping against the bullies is unique for, I think it's largely unique for humans. No, but experiments with both very young children and adults will show that we have indeed innate reaction to inequality, to unfairness, and things like that. I don't think genes have been identified, but it's been shown pretty clearly that the brain functions in a different way. I don't know about that. Yeah, sorry.
So the mechanism here providing a benefit to the policing behavior is the non-additivity, right? So, I mean,
yeah.
if you have three units and the one gets two of them. So I could think of two alternatives that are applicable to humans. One is that the one that's helped is, say, a weaker individual, right? And maybe it's young or something, and then in the future helps back, right? Another alternative is just, the image or the reputation of the policer's increase because it's helping a weaker one. So those are two kind of logical alternatives for humans.
Well, the first one is kind of reciprocity, in a sense. And I was trying to make the point that reciprocity wouldn't work because, if you help the strong against the weak, right, that you will be equally motivated to help the strong against the weak rather than the weak against the strong. If you're just motivated by reciprocity, you'll be more motivated to help the strong. Right?
Not necessarily.
Well, it's
the younger one could possibly have increased ability to help.
Well, it may happen, but if there's a tiger who will eat that young one, or I don't know, something else, so it's much less likely. Yeah.
Okay. It's just something that occurred to me just as you were speaking there, and I'm no great expert on Nietzsche, but he has this distinction between the master morality and the slave morality, and he argues that over the history of humanity there have been different societies that had quite different takes on this issue. So it's not necessarily the case that all human societies have always had the idea that the bully should be suppressed and that the weak guy should be lifted up. I just wonder how that whole sort of discourse fits in with this kind of work.
Well,
kind of a throwaway comment, really.
Yeah, here, of course, I was talking about that initial transition, right, from a very hierarchical society to an egalitarian society. Once the first civilizations emerged, there was a reverse transition. But if we look again across the whole set of hunter-gatherers, this is universal, really, and that's kind of the motivation for anthropologists to talk about this as a syndrome, behavioral syndrome and behavioral preferences.
So then what Nietzsche calls the slave morality would be the one that evolved first, and then master morality is something that's a feature, an unusual feature of certain societies. Okay.
Well, in a sense here, that first ape state model that I described at the very beginning, the preferences and the behavior that evolves there is that weak individuals, they accept their role as slaves, right? And dominant individuals, they dominate. And according to all these models, yeah, that's still in our genes. Right, depending on the situation. We try to dominate. If we encounter somebody very strong, yeah, we kind of move back. But with health and behavior, again, it's in addition to this, that's something that makes more.
So I enjoy the talk, and I'm puzzled, though, by your statement, a very strong statement, that bullying is universal, but that helping is only in humans, or this egalitarian instinct, so to speak, is only in humans. And so I wonder if you would comment on the bonobos.
Well, it's not just bonobos. Of course, helping happens in chimpanzees, and coalitions are well known in a number of other mammals. Yeah, but for example, in chimpanzees, coalitions can happen. And sometimes individuals can resist, like two individuals can resist jointly to alpha male. But the size of these coalitions is much, much smaller, and they are very short-lived. So what I meant, it's more, I think, a quantitative difference. While in humans, it's really happens at a very large scale, and very often. In animals, it does happen, but much, much rarer. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.